This special Super Bowl week episode of Patriots Talk is presented by Locker Room App, a place for live audio conversations about the sports you care about.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Hey, what's up, everybody? Welcome into Tom Curran's Patriots Talk podcast. Hell of a pod today as Super Bowl 55 approaches. We'll talk to Devin McCourty, Walter Payton Man of the Year nominee. We're pulling for that guy. He's going to talk to us about the process of getting that rock back up the hill so the Patriots are not spectators for Super Bowl 56 and beyond. Also, Jenny Vrentis from Sports Illustrated, one of the best writers in the country, will join us to talk about her story that she did on gap year Patriots, the ones who never got a ring who are here. Also, we have a little news for you on some of the opt-outs that Dev is going to drop on us as well. So stay tuned for a tremendous Patriots Talk of it. Look who's here, the old friend, our guy, Devin McCourty. Couldn't be happier to have you. How you doing, bud?
I'm doing well, man. Always good to be able to do anything with you, man.
You're great. Before we get into some football talk, I do want to congratulate you and ask you about the honor of the Walter Payton Man of the Year nomination. What does it mean to you?
No, I appreciate that. It's been an unbelievable honor, I think. All of the guys we have in the locker room, like behind you, you got, you know, Jules with his book, James White, you know, Slate, so many great guys. And I think I've gotten an opportunity to represent these guys three times. And I would say what really sticks out is earlier this week, Monday, we got to get on a Zoom call like this with the Walter Payton, you know, with his family, his wife and his daughter and his son, Roger Goodell, and all of the people at Nationwide. And you got to really see the behind the scenes of why this award has gotten to the level that it's at. So, you know, no matter who wins, I think you have a company like Nationwide who pours everything into it. They've donated over $1.3 million to players, charities. You have the NFL and the Payton family who's passionate about it. They put in the NFL honors. The guys, you know, have been on the field for the Super Bowl game. Like, they've really made this honor something really special. And I think guys care about it. Guys already have done a ton of work in the community. But now we have an award that represents the importance of it. I think it's an unbelievable honor.
And you guys are competitive. I mean, you would like to win the award. I mean, it's a beautiful, you have the beautiful insignia logo that is on your jersey, I believe, the next year. And you do so much work. I do want to talk to you about that, but it is a competitive, once you're in something, you're like,
everything, everything's competitive. I mean, guys love that we get the little decal on the back of our helmet that you get to wear for the rest of the season once the nominations come out, and you get to represent that. So like you said, everything is competitive from inside your locker room to against other teams. Like, everyone wants to win anything that you get opportunity to win. So unbelievable honor and excited to see who wins on Saturday. No matter what, it'll be a great guy and a great representation of the NFL.
Dev, before, again, we get to football, I do want to ask you this. This was obviously an incredibly wrenching year on so many different fronts. And I think the pandemic ratcheted up so much and brought to the fore so many of the conversations that you and I have had privately over the years about the social justice aspects of things and inequalities and things that you've worked for prior to the way things bubbled up and bubbled over this year. Meanwhile, you were also dealing with, you know, an incredible personal and family tragedy. You lost a child prior to birth. And I salute the effort that you made on those fronts for the charity and the helping folks to be more acknowledging of the differences and the strains that Black Americans feel while also dealing with that. How'd you shoulder it all?
You know, it was tough. But this year I felt like I got to represent so much more than myself. I think obviously over the last couple years, you know, because of all the conversations we've had, I wanted to be out there doing things for the voiceless. And whether it was myself and J-Mac and Deron and Slate at the State House, whether it was getting guys to come to another event that we had, just getting guys on our team more awareness. And 2020 hits, so much goes on. And now I got everybody's attention. And I just jumped and poured everything out of myself into that of, you know, having different people come in and do Zoom talks with us about the different things that they do, how we can help. And then on the backhand, like you said, from a personal standpoint, I got to represent my wife, go out there and play. And I got to represent so many people who I didn't realize who go through, you know, any type of infant loss. And, you know, the Tears Foundation was huge. I got to wear cleats to represent them, and we got to donate to that. But I just felt like when I went out there, I had so many people supporting me, and I got to represent them that I could just go out there and be free, because so many people were kind of pushing for me this year. And unbelievable to go out there and, you know, take on this year with that kind of support, even though it was a tough year. There were definitely some silver lining moments for me this year.
Well, you know that we continue to have you and your family in our thoughts and prayers, and we thank you for all you've done in our communities. There's one organization that I find fascinating that I wanted to highlight quickly, and that's Uncornered. Can you tell people about that? And is there any way that you could explain for folks who wanted to get involved either directly or donation-wise?
Yeah, Boston Uncornered is awesome. I think you take the people that society tells you stay away, you know, formerly incarcerated, gang members, all of these people who have come up in tough situations, you take them in and you're like, get rid of them. And Boston Uncornered says, no, bring them to us. We're going to put them in school, and we're not going to just put them in school and get them going the right path. We're going to give them a stipend of money that allows them to focus on their schoolwork and focus on being better. And I've gotten an opportunity to talk to multiple people who are in the program, people who have now gotten out of the program and become now CRs, which are people who are like mentors to the other people in there. And they go identify different gang members to bring in. And they say how it wasn't really about them. It was about them creating a new life and a new image for their kids or for their nephews and cousins, that when they now saw them, they didn't see just a gang member, say a college educated person. So Boston Uncornered, if you want to go donate, but I would just tell you, I want to say it's bostonuncornered.org. I'm not 100%. Yeah. But if you want to just go, just learn about it. And I think it will move you in whatever way you want to go from there, whether it's given a financial donation, but maybe it might just going around them and being around these people to see how you can help and how much you can learn from them. I think you'd be blown away if you just take 5 minutes to just read up on it.
I tell you, that's one thing about everything that's happened this year, and really for the last 5 to 10 years, we need more dialogue. We need more interactions. We need more times where a Tom Curran speaking to a Devin McCourty, or guys like me are talking to guys like you who look like us, so that we can understand this. We're all pulling in the same direction. There shouldn't be this massive wall of, I don't want to be intrusive, I don't want to ask a question, because all I know is with you, if I have a question, I ask it. If you have a question, you ask it. We talk about it. It makes so much progress.
Yeah, I really wish we could take our locker room and take it to businesses, take it to school, high schools, take it to colleges and say, hey, let's create a level of trust in here and let's just open up. And we were able to do that multiple times this year. And through that, we really got to know each other on a very deeper sense. And, you know, as I continue, like I'm reading a book, The Culture Code, and learning about why certain businesses, whether it's Google, whether it's, you know, great sports teams, why they create this culture, something they do. And one of the first things they say is everyone talks to everyone. There's no, this guy is the CEO, so he doesn't talk to the janitor. No, everyone, if you work here, if you're an employee, we all talk. And I think as much as we can do that as possible, we start to learn sometimes what makes us different is what makes us great. And I think more and more people have to do that.
Ready to pivot to some football?
Yeah, let's get into it.
All right. So here's a Super Bowl going on and the Patriots aren't in it. Not only are the Patriots not in it, they weren't a game away. How unusual is it for you to be in early February, pretty well rested?
Yeah, but it's also a reminder of how spoiled we really are and how fortunate we've been. It was a little bit of a reminder of how hard it is to get to that game, how hard it is to make the playoffs. Listen, we don't have a lot of those guys that were in all of these playoff games, in all those Super Bowls. Like our team's transitioned a little bit, where we don't have as many of those faces, especially with the opt-outs that happened this year. We don't have, you know, I've played in 5 Super Bowls. We don't have that many guys that have played in, you know, the 4 Super Bowls or the 5 Super Bowls. So it was a learning experience, I think, this year for a lot of guys. And even for me in year 11, you know, I've been fortunate. I've seen the reality of both sides because how close me and Jay are. And he's talked to me about that all the time. So, but I think it fuels you. It makes you want to get better. It makes you want to get back, especially us older guys. Like, you're playing for one reason. You want to be in that game. So it definitely gives us some motivation and you know, we got to dial in and get back to the playoffs and give ourselves an opportunity. I think that'll be everybody's focus.
There's a feeling that if this were a mountain and you guys were pushing the rock up that mountain, it's my personal feeling that every time you didn't get to the Super Bowl and get that rock up all the way, you were only about halfway down the mountain. I have a feeling, disabuse me of this if you can, that the rock is at the bottom of the hill and you guys are starting from the very bottom pushing.
Leave it to Tom Curran. I know I see all your tweets and all your articles.
Negative.
No, I mean, I understand. Listen, for years when we didn't make it to the Super Bowl, we lost the AFC Championship. Mm-hmm. We lost in the Super Bowl. We didn't win it. So, yeah, it's easy to say that. And this year we didn't make the playoffs. So, like, are we at the bottom? We're where a lot of teams are that didn't make the playoffs. Are we at the dead bottom? No, there's some teams that's probably a little bit below us. Are we, like, half an inch from the top? No, like, we're not there yet either. But we're pushing. And I think we got to just stay focused on that and give ourselves an opportunity. As you can see, I have another what's-the-name coming in. But I think we will have a chance to be back in that game, try to get ourselves doing something that helps us. But we got to just focus on ourselves and no one else, and we'll see how that all works out.
Who's coming back among the opt-outs? Will Chung and Hightower be back?
From my understanding, they'll all be back. Be Bold and High, Chung. So I can't wait. Those are my guys. Cannon. I just can't wait to be back around those guys, even outside of football, just seeing them every day, seeing their nice faces.
All right. I know how you guys are just do your job, and your job is not personnel. Your job is not evaluating or scouting. But you've been doing this long enough, and you're probably a football fan too. Are you curious at all as to what Bill and Dave Ziegler and whoever else is in charge of player acquisition are going to do this offseason with that big boatload of cap space and the 15th overall pick and everything? Do you pay attention?
Yeah, I mean, I don't like get into it. So like a lot of times, like when the draft comes around, people are like, who do you want? I'm like, I don't know. Like, I don't watch, like, I don't scout players. Like, I don't look at that. So, but yeah, you're always interested to see like, what position do we get? Like, you know, does a guy end up becoming a good, like this year we draft Kyle Duggar. And I reach out to him when we first sign him. And I'm like, oh, we got a D2 safety, you know, like, you know, let me see how it goes and try to get to know him, help him out as much as I can. And we get to training camp and this guy walks in. I'm like, the hell? we start practicing and he starts moving and doing stuff. And I was like, how did you end up D2 again? Like, absolute freak, like run, jumping, hitting. So I try not to get into it because, and I know from the outside, like when, like you write on the team, you speak about the team, you have to break down all of the things that happens. But I think between free agency and the draft, guys do get excited because you know, like you're going to get new players, you're going to lose players, you know, like last year, like it's a bittersweet thing. You get new guys in there, like adding Cam to the team this year and how cool he was in the locker room and the vibe that he brought to the locker room. So I think all of us, especially coming off a season where you don't have the success you want, you know, things are going to change. Like I said that, you know, probably 4 or 5 times at the end of last year when we were already out of playoffs, like things are going to change. Things change anyway in the NFL, whether you win or lose, but when you you lose in a way that no one's used to, things are definitely going to change. So I'm anxious to see. And I think as you get older, I'm always kind of apprehensive even about talking about the future, because I always remember Keyshawn Johnson one draft talking about the draft. And I think he was in Carolina maybe, and Dwayne Jarrett got drafted to Carolina. He talked about helping him out. And then like 2 weeks later, they released him. So I'm always like, as you get older, you're like, hey, I'm excited, but you just don't know. And I think for me, wherever I'm at, I'm on the team, hopefully. And my vision now as a player is to try to be as good as I can be as a player, but really in helping out these guys, like all the things that Kevin Faulks, the Mayos, the Vince Wilforts, the Lee Bodens that they taught me, like I want to make sure I pass those things down to these guys that are coming in. So I think it's a mix of all of that. And I think more importantly than anything, I want to be back in the playoffs. I want to be back having a chance to win a championship. Like that's what I want. There's no other reason at 34 to be playing.
Is it wild to see? And I know you consume, but you're smart enough to, you consume it, but it doesn't seem to let you, it doesn't piss you off the way I think some players, they get pissed off when they see the conversations about things. Everybody's different. I can get a comment on Twitter and I'm like, what the hell? Relax. It's not a big deal. But has it amazed you to see how we have pivoted, whether it's media, fans, national media, to saying these guys are effed. They're not coming back.
Yeah, but it's Tom Brady. Like, I think we got so used to having Tom that, like, people are shocked. Like, bro, when Indy lost Peyton Manning, the next year they won two games, I think. Or the year he was hurt.
Yeah, he was down, and then Luck came in. But they had the guy. Like, after Montana, they had the guy. After five, they had Rodgers. So.
And that's the thing, though. So for us, for everyone to be happy with New England, we would have had to win one game this year. And then everyone would have been like, they're getting Trevor Lawrence. They only won one. They're back. They're getting Trevor Lawrence. But because we lost Tom and we then went on to win seven games, which is not like the worst thing ever in NFL, you know, you win seven games, but everyone's like, well, they can't get back to the Super Bowl. Whereas I think for other teams, it wasn't like that. Like when the Colts got Luck, it was like, they're going to be good at some point. Like they're going to be fine. Like it didn't mean they were going to the Super Bowl the next year. But I think for us, it's like, what is this team going to do to be back in Super Bowl 56? Right. And there's no in between. And I think it sucks as a player, because you realize more people around the organization would have been happier if we would have won one game and had the first pick to draft Trevor Lawrence than to go out there and fight and get seven games. And still, because, you know, like I said, culture is about something you do day in and day out. And I learned that big time from Jay when he was in Cleveland. And, you know, why Cleveland's doing well now is because they had to get new guys, because those older guys that they had, and they weren't even old, but the Danny Sheltons and all those guys that they draft, they had done so much losing that they weren't losing, but the culture was losing, because that's what the organization was trying to do. So now they got the new wave of guys that they don't know that old culture. They know winning, the Jarvis Landrys, the Odell Beckhams, those guys come in, the Myles Garretts. And I think that's what we still have. Like, we didn't win as much as we want, but we have a lot of guys who believe in winning. Obviously, starting with Coach Belichick and down. But, like, those guys in the locker, they want to win. It's just got to learn how to win. Got to learn how to win now with no Tom Brady. All of those things continue to show up. We had to try to learn how to win in 1 year without Tom, High, Chung, Jamie, KV. Like, we had to learn how to win without a lot of guys. Off
season to get ready for it.
So, you know, next year, and it's not an excuse, next year we got to learn how to do that. It's going to be learning how to win without somebody else, you know, and we'll see how it all works out. But I think we as players are a lot happier with the way the season ended and the outlook going forward than everybody else. And it should be like that. But I think we feel more confident, than a lot of other people. And, you know, I don't know, you might be replaying this at the end of next year being like, boy, Devin McCourty was off on that. But it's just, I think, how we feel, and especially as competitors.
No, I'm ready to do the pivot. No, we got $60 million of cap space for you guys. We got the 15th overall pick.
So your next article is going to be positive?
12-4. Yeah. No, I'm on that 12-4 train now. You don't last this long in the business without being smart enough. Test the wind. I know which way this is blowing. Tampa's 6-10. Brady, you know. Anyway, hey, thank you for the time. All right. So as you can see, Dev is in the midst of going through the media car wash today. We had an 8:30 Friday morning appointment with our guy. The phone was ringing. I don't know how credible that will be as a bite for us to snip and use on our TV shows, but the point is clear. You know, they are not, in his estimation, starting at the bottom. And the news that he gave us about the opt-outs, that's fairly critical. I assumed that Patrick Chung would be back. He's been very outspoken, I think, throughout the season in terms of support and being there for his team and encouraging in a way that you could see he was coming back. Bolden, we knew, but Dante Hightower coming back, that's a massive add for the Patriots, if indeed he is coming back. And I'm sure that Dev is speaking from what he understands, but he's not making any announcements on their behalf. So Hightower is the biggest one to me. And then Marcus Cannon at right tackle, if he is indeed coming back, then that's, you know, a huge thing because it moves guys along the offensive line. Mike Onwenu couldn't go back to left guard if indeed Joe Tooney signs elsewhere. So there's some interesting news there as well from Dev. And I do encourage you to check out some of those organizations he's involved with. Let's pivot now away from Dev and talk more Patriots with our friend Jenny Vrentis. After Jenny's done, it's about 25 minutes. Jen, I'm going to circle up with you and give you a little game preview and what I'm looking for in Super Bowl 55. And here is my friend Jenny Vrentis. And, you know, before, Jenny, I get into the latest of your great stories relative to the Patriots that you've written for Sports Illustrated. So I wanted to make sure that I had the arc of your career correct. So I just Googled quick, knew I'd find some info about where you've been. And yep, you were at the Star Ledger from 2007 to 2013. But right there on the LinkedIn, it has your education, of course, as well. Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism. Big brain. That's why she comes up with all these great story ideas. But also we got Penn State from 02 to 06 with a Bachelor of Science in Biochemistry and Molecular Biology. What the hell was this 180 to sports journalism and running around on the Patriots beat grabbing stories that I should be doing?
I definitely took a left turn, Tom. I was working in a science lab. I did my senior thesis in a geobiology lab. My parents are engineers. My sister was the same major 3 years before me. She went on to get her PhD. She still works in science. So it was definitely quite an unconventional turn for me. But I started working for the Daily Collegian at Penn State and just really fell in love with journalism and actually was covering the women's volleyball team at Penn State. That was my first beat for the Daily Collegian. And the coach there, Russ Rose, who has kind of a dynasty of his own, not kind of, he definitely has a dynasty, racked up a bunch of national titles in a small window. And at the time they were kind of in between successes, but I covered the team that season and he said, "You seem to really like this, interacting with people, talking to people. Seems like you would enjoy this more than being at a bench in a science lab." And it kind of got the wheels turning a little bit. And ultimately I ended up here.
I think what's so great about reading your stuff is it's so inquisitive, which kind of almost maybe kind of a little bit has a root in the science to investigate, to get things. And again, I'm oversimplifying. I never took biology past 10th grade, but you're putting things under a microscope, obviously, and trying to figure out why they work. What are the elements that make things, what are the flagella that propel them forward?
No, I mean, I think that's exactly right. I do think there is some carryover, maybe not, you know, okay, I'm not talking about methanogenic bacteria or whatever I did my, you know, senior thesis on, but that process, you're exactly right. It's kind of like a scientific method. You're collecting facts. You're trying to state something and make sure you have all the facts to support it. So I do think there's a lot of crossovers, you know, the process of reasoning, you know, all of those kinds of things. I think there is a little bit of a relation there.
Yeah. And you really too, and this is something that honestly, I don't really use the scientific method as probably as well as I should and peer review my stories. Like if I have a hunch, boom, it's going. It is out. But I think that probably you have a more critical mind because you speak to so many people when you do your stories. Before we do this story that you and Greg Bishop did on the gap year Patriots, the Patriots who came aboard in say 05 or later and figured, man, we're going to get ourselves a ring because that's how things work down there. And nobody got them from 05 to 13. But before we get to that and the great number of people you spoke to, you have parachuted in numerous times on the Patriots beat and done some excellent stories. What are maybe 3 to 5 of the most enjoyable stories that you've done? Even if you don't have the stories at your fingertips, anecdotes about what this beat has offered you as somebody who's not necessarily up to your eyeballs in it here.
Well, thanks for the nice words. I appreciate it. You are always very supportive. So I appreciate you saying that. I think, you know, living in New York and during the Patriots dynasty, I mean, I covered the Jets as a beat writer, but then when I transitioned to a national reporter, the Patriots are so close by. And so I would go to a lot of Patriots games. And so I think you naturally become a little bit more connected to storylines that you're geographically close to or that you're around a little bit more often. I think that the main one that sticks out in my mind was I wrote about the friendship between Bill Belichick and Nick Saban. And that was really an interesting reporting process, being able to dive into just how long they've been friends and how many experiences they've shared and how they've had these parallel paths of success. And there are just so many things that cross over between the two of them. So kind of telling an episodic history of all of the places that they would, you know, meet up at West Point when they were both assistants, to just kind of have a quiet area to go over cover two defense and, you know, what the backfield should look like. And to where they are now, you know, the most successful coach in the NFL and the most successful coach in college. So that was I learned a lot in that process just about why their programs have been so great. I think the other one that stands out is I did a story on the Belichick trope of I can get Johnny Foxborough down the street to throw a better pass than you, which he used to do with Tom Brady, and the idea being coach Tom Brady the hardest in the building, which set a standard for every other player. I remember, you know, hearing the anecdote of, you know, Randy Moss comes in 2007 and he sees Bill kind of cussing out Tom or getting on him for like a missed throw in practice. And he realizes like, oh my gosh, like I'm going to have to up my game a little bit. So you could just, even a great player like Moss, you could see the impact on him. So those are two that stand out, but it has been pretty remarkable covering the teams. And I, you know, there's always the, oh, you want, some people will say you want fresh storylines in the Super Bowl, but I kind of liked when the Patriots were going back because I felt like you were seeing something you're never going to see again. We get to watch it live and we get to see this incredible dynasty, this run that we may never see again unfold in front of us. And so that was, I really enjoyed having the opportunity to have a front row seat.
It's funny too, because when you say the fresh storylines, the interesting thing about the Patriots is they were so ever changing and you knew Belichick was going to constantly reboot that the team, the uniforms and the two main protagonists remained the same, but things were always churning below, as we saw really from 2017 on, the churn that was going on. So it's the same people, it's the same marriage, but it's the marriage at a different juncture. And how it's to me, it was, we'll never experience something like that again over a 20-year period. I mean, you could look at the Walsh and Montana relationship and it was a snapshot. It was 1980 79 80 81 to 88. I mean, that's 2012 to 2019 here, and there's 14 years or so, math is bad, that they weren't involved in. So it's just, it would just be a small bite of it. Again, before we get to the gap year story, what's your process for story generation? Because again, you've written so many cool ones that don't even have anything to do with the Patriots. And there is a tendency among, at least with me, where I look at it and go, that's a friggin' great story idea. Why didn't I think of that? Well, probably because you weren't thinking of it, A, and B, if you had, you'd go, that's too much work. But what's your story generation process like, and then turning it into something?
Yeah. Well, when I was on a beat, it was totally different because, you know, the beat is daily grind. You're there at practice every day and you have to be on top of every little thing that happens with the team. So when I went to SI, I had a chance to sort of pick something small and dive into it and make it a little bit bigger. And I think that's sort of been the genesis of a lot of the stories that I've done, is something that, you know, a little bit of a tidbit or a nugget that you hear. The Belichick Saban thing, I remember hearing that they had these West Point meetings where they'd go and study film together in the late 80s. And I was interested in fleshing that out a little bit more. And as I started to do that, I realized that the bigger story of their friendship over decades was the better one to tell. Or the Johnny Foxborough thing, you'd always hear people say, like, Belichick will get on Brady as hard as everyone else. And I was just curious, like, well, what does that look like? Can we get people to tell those experiences and stories? So a lot of times it's just maybe taking a tiny snippet of something and then thinking there has to be a little bit more to it. Let's see if we can figure out what that is.
I'm sure that you've requested Bill over the years. Have you had opportunities to one-on-one speak with him?
Yeah, I spoke to him for the Belichick Saban story. He called me in the evening, I think on the way home from the facility, and we spoke for about 45 minutes. And I had already spoken to Saban, and so was able to kind of build off some of that conversation with Bill. And I also had the chance to be the pool reporter through the PFWA for the Super Bowl in Atlanta, which was a really awesome experience. It's very something special to be watching a team prepare for the Super Bowl. Everything that goes into it, that week of practices leading up to the game. And what stands out in my mind is they had kind of a family day at the stadium. And it was, you know, Belichick had his granddaughter, Blakely, was there, and he had like macadamia nuts for her as a snack. And you saw all the players with their families just scattered around the field. And you could tell that was, you know, there was a different kind of appreciation. Things were obviously winding down. That would be the last Super Bowl they would win together. And there was just kind of this different appreciation for the moment. It seemed like that week.
It's funny, I had the same opportunity to do that in 2011, the Patriots-Giants second Super Bowl, because Peter King had been doing it and he had Hall of Fame duties. So I was in to cover the Patriots practice, and it was wild. I mean, you're watching all that. And the thing was, is Brady's family was out there and he's in his jersey and stuff, and they didn't interact or anything. You know, you just note that. It's not like, oh, big Fisher. No, it's how it was. But then he goes in and then he comes back out fully dressed, and he stayed there with his family and sisters and parents and Kevin Youkilis and whoever else for like 45 minutes, just hanging on the field. You know, if somebody else did that, it would have been noteworthy as well. But you have this icon who is in his, at that point, fifth Super Bowl, coming back out to do that. And I do remember him walking out too, Jenny. As he's walking out, he sees me in the, like, the first row of the, he goes, what are you doing here? I said, I got to do the pool report. I said, how you feeling? He goes, I'm going to fucking kick their ass.
It was like, wow.
And I'm like, oh, I'd put everything on New England. I would fire you. And the next day, of course, they don't win the Super Bowl. But tell me about this. Is a good segue then. They don't win the Super Bowl. Tell me about some of the players and what you found is a common thread between the players who went through New England ringless.
Yeah. One of the most common things we heard was people would just say how many times they get asked, or the assumption is made that they have a ring. Oh, you know, you played with Brady and Belichick during the dynasty years. You have to have had a ring. And the answers are varied. Oh, I was on the 07 team. Nope. The Manningham catch, Giants part two. I was supposed to have a ring. I was on a team that didn't even go to the Super Bowl, and just the surprise that they get from other people, because it was such a remarkable run. And, you know, 9 years without the Super Bowl, it's kind of silly to call that like a drought, but because there are teams like the Browns and the Bills at the time had longer postseason droughts versus a Super Bowl quote unquote drought. But because the level and the standard was so high there, and that so many people went to New England expecting to have the chance to win a ring, because there always was that chance. I mean, they were in the playoffs every year, you know, with the exception of 2008. And so it felt very real and very possible to do it. And so to hear those players kind of reflect on having gone there and gotten close or missed out on the opportunity, it was an array of different feelings that they had looking back.
You talked to so many different guys, and I'll just list a few of them here. As I read it, I said, I'm going to grab this, but there's Welker. There was no Logan Mankins, who was probably the most celebrated of the ringless Patriots, came in 2005, right after the 3 and 4 years, and then was jettisoned at the beginning of 2014, right before the next stretch. And it's an all-pro possible Hall of Fame player. But you have Welker, you have Lloyd, you have Ellis Hobbs, you have Ross Tucker, you have Adalys Thomas, you have Sean Springs. Help me out more. Give me some.
Yeah, though, those are a lot of the big ones we talked to. Brandon Lloyd, he was there in 2012, you know, a year when they didn't go to the Super Bowl. Rich Ornberger, who was he told a great story of how Belichick would use him as kind of comedic relief if the team needed an emotional lift. So yeah, I mean, there's 168. We had Reed Foster, who had done some research for us at SI. He went through and he tallied it up, and the number was 168. Actually, he'd done the tally 2 years ago and it was 169, but then Brian Hoyer came back and won a ring. So
good tidbit.
Yeah.
One of the great quotes that I found early on was Brandon Lloyd, who again was only here in 2012, and he was a good downfield receiver for the Patriots, but he just is an odd guy. Bottom line, it was just a strange fella, but he was not a dummy by any stretch, and he was not an unproductive player. But Brandon Lloyd said at one point to you and Greg Bishop, they shouldn't have won that many Super Bowls. Bill wins with situational football. The players aren't that talented. It's the discipline. It's how these practices were at such a high level. We practice situational moments. So when it came to running, having a shot play from our side of the field across as a 50 and goes into the red zone, and then changing the personnel and just going right up the ball, snapping it, catching the defense, trying to get their big guys in to stop the run. They did that in practice, whereas other teams set up those specific plays. Brandon Lloyd was great, but it is interesting to hear him articulate that it's not so much, it's just the cauldron that he puts them in that makes them so good.
Yeah, that was an interesting point. Actually, Greg Bishop did that interview. And I thought it was a really great snapshot. And you would hear, you know, players discuss, because the debate right now in the wake of Danny Amendola's comments, but just in the larger picture of Tom Brady going to the Super Bowl in Tampa, and there's always going to be this Brady Belichick debate, but there are a lot of things that Belichick did that kind of set up this routine and set up this level of preparation that players who had never played on another team and then went elsewhere were stunned by later in their careers, or free agents who came in late in their careers said, I never experienced this anywhere else in the NFL.
Is there some melancholy with some of these guys? Ellis Hobbs was interesting. He was very articulate on, did you speak to Ellis?
Yeah, I did. Yeah.
You know, he didn't kick himself as much about what happened. He was very matter of fact about, look, we ran a play defensively on the game winning touchdown in the 2007 Super Bowl. We ran a zero blitz, which meant I was on an island against a 6'5 receiver, and I had to take away the more likely way for them to score, which would have been on a slant. So that meant they had an absolute pasture out to my right. He was very matter of fact about it. Was he melancholy, or was he just accepting of it?
He was pretty accepting, and I thought he had a really good perspective about football is something I did. I played it at a high level. It's hard to get to the NFL. I defied the odds to even play in the NFL, played in a Super Bowl, but it's not my whole life. It doesn't define me. And he was confident in what he'd done to that point in his career, his preparation, his how he played that call. He was confident in everything he did. And he pointed out that a lot of what Belichick does is understand the probabilities and the odds on certain plays. And in that play, in Hobbs's mind, the inside route was the more likely one. That was the bigger threat for the touchdown. So he defended the inside route. And I think in his mind, that's why he was, one of the reasons he was at peace with it is because he felt like he did the smartest thing he could in that situation. But just the bigger picture is, you know, we often boil down careers into Super Bowl wins or not, or even a performance in a single game, you lose the nuance. It's black and white. Does a team win or lose? And just hearing his perspective on, you know, this one, whether or not I have a ring doesn't define my whole career, doesn't define my life. I thought that was an important perspective to include.
Were there others who felt more incomplete as a result that you sensed?
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting. Adalius Thomas was one of those, and he had a ring in Baltimore, so this wasn't his only chance. But I think it was that 07 season was particularly gutting for a lot of players because it was so special, because they had been undefeated till the final game, and they had made it all the way through. You know, it's hard to win one game in the NFL, but it's hard to win every game until the final one, and it's just this emotional letdown. And so Adalius Thomas said he has never watched the game and he doesn't think he ever will. Dante Stallworth was also on that team. And he talked about, it's almost worse knowing that you were that good, but you couldn't get the ring.
Who was it who said they wish they had lost earlier? Was it Stallworth?
Hobbs said he wished they had lost earlier. And I thought that was interesting in just how exhausting it is to go through a season. And Hobbs remembered Bill saying after the AFC Championship game, can you win one more? And he took that as kind of like if you're running gassers in the summertime and someone says, can you win one more? Now, that might not have been how Bill intended it. I do think a lot of times Bill has this message of it's the next game and you have to just win the next one. But the way he received it was, wow, it's someone asking me to run one more gasser on a hot August day and I am exhausted. And he said he felt like the team was exhausted because they had this pressure every week of winning. They make it through the regular season undefeated. And then there's the pressure of if you lose in the playoffs, it's all for naught.
Yeah. And it was such a grinding end of the season, whether it was against Philadelphia, against Baltimore. And then the final game, to me, Jenny, you covered the game too, I'm sure. Well, you might've been a Jets beat writer, but that 2007 regular season finale, when the Giants are playing for nothing, their place is secure in the playoffs. The Patriots' place is secure. It's one of the greatest games in NFL history because of the import, but because that was playing for something other than they had no reason to put up the fight they did, the Giants. I just thought it was incredibly noble, and all the Coughlin and Belichick and Brady and Eli and Moss chasing a record. I think that is one of the greatest games in NFL history.
It really was. And I Super Bowl 42 was the first Super Bowl that I covered, which set a high standard for all Super Bowls. After that point, I can't remember if I was at the regular season finale or not. I remember what happened in the game and I remember how the game unfolded, but for some reason, I can't remember if I was actually there covering it or not, but it's exactly right. Like, and that, you know, Hobbs described that sense of saying like, they came out of that game, okay, they won and they completed the perfect regular season, but it just felt like the Giants, if they had another shot at them, they would get it next time.
Yeah, and it'll be interesting on Sunday because it's Steve Spagnuolo.
Right.
And Brady right. Again. I had one other, but maybe let's just pivot now actually then to that conversation that we've been having all week. Sean Springs, who was part of the 2009 Patriots as they rebooted from the Seymour, Harrison, Brewski, Vrabel, you name it, years. Harrison, I think I said him. But he was here in 09. It was a dysfunctional season. I talked to Sean Springs plenty. He wasn't a dysfunctional guy. He was a good teammate. I think everyone gets colored with, oh, they all suck. They were all pains in the ass. He was not. He was a good guy. But he says, did you speak to Sean?
Greg did that interview, actually, but it was a really good quote. Yeah.
Sean says, I'm going to be honest with you as to whether it's Brady or Belichick. It's Tom Brady, bro. It was Tom. He's the ultimate leader. He's the ultimate fucking winner. And don't get me wrong, Bill is amazing, but it's hard to say for me how amazing Bill is. I had some great coaches, Gibbs, Holmgren. If Coach Holmgren had Tom Brady, he'd have six Super Bowls too. I don't even want to put a number on it because I don't want to disrespect Bill, but I mean, it's like 70% Tom. I'm not trying to be controversial, but Tom is a fucking animal, man. Then Brandon Lloyd answered with, I'm going to take some of that 70% away from Brady because Bill is a general manager and he wasn't going to screw up the salary cap, but no one could make more money than Tom Brady. Tom Brady was so good. It was like guys would say, yes, I'll take less to play with Tom Brady. But in reality, they had no choice. He's the best player in the game and makes that much money. And then Rich Hornberger, in his inimitable way, says that at the helm, obviously, it's Belichick, but Brady was second in command. What's your view on, what's your reflection on this in their perspective and yours?
I think they were the perfect partnership. And I think it would be hard to parse out who was responsible for what. I think they worked together, and I don't think either of them would have won six Super Bowls on their own. I think they played off of each other. So I would assign equal credits. And I think what you're seeing in Tampa, you know, Brady goes to a team, you know, he handpicks a team that has great weapons on the outside, and, you know, they're building their offensive line, and the defense has a lot of great players. And, you know, he goes to the Super Bowl in the first year, and maybe that enters the conversation. But I also don't really think that's fair necessarily, because I think what Brady carries with him to Tampa Bay is based off of what he built in New England. And so that level of not panicking in games, which I've heard from Bucs players all week, that Brady brought this sense of, you know, even if things aren't going well mid-season or in a game, either way, don't panic, you know, we'll get back to it. This belief that you can win, he brought that from New England, right? So that was an outgrowth too of this partnership that he had with Bill. I think it would be very hard to, you know, separate who contributed what. I just think it was this remarkable marriage. And I think that Patrick Mahomes and Andy Reid have the chance to have that kind of marriage. Now, you don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves, but if you look at some of these partnerships that have yielded multiple Super Bowls, Montana Walsh, Brady Belichick, that looks like what Reid and Mahomes have.
Sure. And it's interesting, and it's, you know, Noel Bradshaw, and even more so perhaps even it's also, and I know Mahomes is probably a better player than a very good and underrated Troy Aikman, but it's a little bit like the Cowboys.
Yeah, absolutely.
They don't have the defense, but they got the three-headed offensive monster with Smith, Irvin, Aikman. Here it's Kelce, Hill, Mahomes, and there's some Alvin Harpers running around in Sammy Watkins, etc. But when we talk about the reboot and the things the Patriots need to do to excel, seemed a lot of uncertainty among these former Patriots that you spoke to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because the question is, you need the quarterback in the NFL to win. But there was also an understanding that Belichick knows how to adjust, and that this year wasn't a good reflection. There were so many player opt-outs. It was an unusual year in a lot of ways. And so I think the sense I got from a lot of former players was there's no way to know if they'll ever win a Super Bowl again, but they're very curious what Bill does, because he always figures out some kind of counterpunch. And really, that was necessary to get that second cluster of Super Bowl rings. The first three, even then, one of the players mentioned to me that even then, I think it was Ellis Hobbs, I didn't put this part in, but even then they were flying under the radar a little bit. You know, that Eagles Super Bowl, people thought T.O. and the Eagles would just blow past the Patriots. And then they're all of a sudden realizing, like, this is a fantastically coached team. And so the Patriots had to adjust. They had to get some fresh talent in. They had to kind of adjust how they built a roster and, you know, be willing to get premium talent in their prime versus at the end of their career. So now there's got to be some counterpunch. And I think Bill will figure it out. I don't know that it'll yield another cluster of Super Bowls, but I don't think this year is representative of what the post-Tom Brady era will be.
Yeah, it's really interesting, too, when you look at how the Patriots built in both of those periods. The first one was obviously Parcells' drafts, Belichick's drafts, some key free agents, not high profile. They play it out for 9 years. They reboot. But when they reboot, it's all again the drafts with McCourty and Slater and Chung and Gronkowski and Hernandez and Chandler Jones and Dante Hightower. But then as Brady proceeds to the latter portion of his career, Jenny, they did in many ways what the Rams are currently doing. Okay, we're going to rent players. We got to maximize. And this is what Bill has talked about. Now, my contention is you can maximize while still not swinging and missing in the second round on the regular, which is what they've done. But the point is true. They almost have to get back to those basics, I think, of the 2019 teams where you're, okay, we got to draft like maniacs here. What happens on Sunday, my friend?
Well, I picked the Chiefs they've been the best team all season. But I will say that I was conflicted about that pick. The Chiefs playing without their tackles, the Bucs having this excellent front four that can get pressure. The only way to control Mahomes is to try to get him off his timing, off his spots. Even though he can throw off balance and he can scoot all over the field, you need to have some kind of pressure up front to affect him in any way. And the Bucs do have the ability to do that. But I did go with the Chiefs just because they've figured out ways all season to, even when they're not at their best or even when they're facing challenges, to just score points. And it's just hard to keep up with their offense.
He's a scooter. That's a good way of describing him.
He really scoots, right?
He doesn't scramble. He scoots around. See, what is interesting to me, and it just dawned on me, you know, really yesterday, because I'm watching Bob Sutton. I was watching the 18 AFC Championship, and I'm watching Bob Sutton, and it was 17-7 going in the fourth quarter, and Bob Sutton's, they put the camera on and go, do you know you're about 9 minutes from the end of your career, you poor guy? But now it's Spagnuolo there. Mm-hmm. That changes. It didn't dawn on me until last time. Oh, shit, Steve Spagnuolo. Oh, Giants link up. This is some kryptonite for Tom Brady.
It is interesting.
It is. Had you thought of it?
Yeah, I thought of it the other week because
sorry on it, you missed it.
No, only because like that was the first Super Bowl that I covered, and being in New York, like being around the Giants, like that's always seared into my head, just what they were able to do to Brady in that game. And like that game has, you know, it's just weird. Different things happen at different points in your career. But for me, since that was the first Super Bowl that I covered, it's really like it has an imprint on how I cover the league or how I see the game. And so I did think of that. But, you know, different teams, different styles, but Spagnuolo really has, you know, he's known Andy Reid for a while. And when Andy brought him in, you know, he gave exactly what that defense needed. And they brought in players like Tyrann Mathieu that just infused that kind of personality. And their front is excellent. You know, Chris Jones is probably doesn't get the attention that he deserves for everything he does up front.
Yeah. I mean, imagine if they still had D Ford and Justin Houston along with Chris Jones and Frank Clark. Holy crap. They're not there, right? D Ford is definitely gone.
Right. Houston. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Houston's elsewhere. Yeah.
Good job, Tom. I thought I blanked out on the person the last second there. All right. Jenny Vrentis, thank you so much for the time. We really appreciate it. As always, you can read Jenny's stuff on Sports Illustrated website. We will make sure to catch up with you again, my friend.
This was so fun. Thanks for having me, Tom.
She's great. She's talented. She works her ass off. That's Jenny Vrentis. All right. I promised it. Super Bowl 55 preview coming up. It's going to be very simple for me. Look, the damage done on the outside, the Chiefs offensive line with both tackles damaged and their center missing a little bit of practice this week with COVID issues. It's going to play into this game. Now, what's interesting to me is that the Chiefs have a modus operandi, an MO of attacking at all times. Todd Bowles loves to blitz. I don't know if you necessarily have to blitz, even though that is in your DNA as a defense. If you can play coverage and bottle up Tyreek Hill and borrow from the Patriots and do some of the things that they've done against Patrick Mahomes to try and keep a lid on an extremely explosive offense by making Hill the focal point of your defense, then you're going to be in business. If you let Tyreek Hill be one-on-one in space, having opportunities against fewer defensive backs, the way we saw earlier this year when the Bucs and the Chiefs played, then you're going to be on your way to getting him the MVP trophy. It's that simple. Don't let the guy you know can ruin the game ruin the game. Stop him. Make Kelce beat you. Make Watkins beat you. Make Clyde Edwards-Helaire beat you. Mecole Hardman. Just don't let the best player on the field beat you. That's the way to keep the game close. The total's 55. If the Bucs do that, this is not going to be a 55 game. Now, my buddy Phil Perry complains incessantly, I think fed by his favorite analyst, Warren Sharp, about the Tampa Bay Buccaneers running the ball on first down. They do it a ton. They do it more than anybody. And they haven't had great success doing so. But here's the thing. 3rd-and-7 to Tom Brady is 3rd-and-4 to everybody else. So even if they're not making massive gains on first and second down, sometimes they pop them. And sometimes you're in second and four. And sometimes later in the game, you've done a good job wearing people down. So you can get some yards. Additionally, more than anything else, it makes sure that you're not throwing on first down, incomplete. Second and 10, if that's incomplete, you're punting. Who's got the ball then? Patrick Mahomes. You want to avoid that. So a balanced attack. Don't worry about Phil Perry and Warren Sharp complaining about running the ball too much on the early downs. Establishing the run. People laugh at it now. It's an analytic circle fest. Trying to say, I have this stat that proves this doesn't work. They're in the Super Bowl. It's kind of working. Even if Brady is forced to convert on 3rd and 6, 3rd and 5, 3rd and 8, he can do it because he's got the guys to do it. And he's an accurate enough passer. So make sure Tyreek Hill doesn't beat you. Continue to be a team that is balanced. Attack when you can. Get through that first quarter wave of nerves and go ahead and win the game. I think Tampa Bay is going to win the game. 23-20. Harrison Butker. Chance to tie it from 47. Blocked by JPP. Yeah. Blocked. Game. Super Bowl 7 for Tom Brady. All right. We appreciate you. Of course, we'll be back next week to talk about all the things that I did not get right with Phil Perry. He'll be in here on Tuesday. And the next Pats podcast, I want you to check that out. Enjoy your weekend. Enjoy Super Bowl 55. Take care.